And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today on the program, we're going to be talking to Charles McLaurin in Mississippi, who is one of the leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and about the battle for freedom in the American South when it was an apartheid South. But there is also storm clouds rolling in from the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about that. But it's going to focus on the book by James Dan. I don't know why I suddenly called him James. He's Jim Dan. Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers, Memories of Mississippi, 1964-65. And at the halfway point, 5:30 or so, we should be speaking to Gallican Gasana, who is one of the many Rwandans and Congolese and Burundis and Tanzanians and others living in Canada who are protesting the visit to Toronto by the former general, now president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. And we will be asking about why there is a protest, where there will be a protest, and some of the details. And then we, at the about 5:40, we expect to talk to Isaac Saney about a program coming up here in Toronto called Africa's Unknown War, Apartheid Terror, Cuba and Southern African Liberation, and that's going to be an event held on September 27th and 28th at the University of Toronto. We will be talking to Isaac Saney about that, and that'll be the latter part of the hour. I don't know if we have Charles McLaurin with us. Are you there, sir? No. Okay. I looked over and saw the back of someone's head, and I thought, maybe they don't. Anyway, and I may also toss in a news item, because I know many of our listeners are following the events in the Middle East very closely. The Russian foreign minister, I think his name is Lavrov, made an interesting and helpful clarification, because if you're trying to follow this, the U.S. is still talking about possible attack on Syria. Many people think, well, the threat is past. According to Mr. Lavrov, the agreement is that they will that is to include this thing about examining Syria for chemical weapons and removing them. He said a very important detail that has to apply also to the rebels, because it's the allegation of the Syrian government, also by the way, the allegation of the Russian government, that the rebels possess illegal chemicals, that they have and have used them. So you cannot say to the government of Syria, well, you give up yours and ignore the others, because he said there was an investigation. There was an investigation, and it was done because the Syrian government had invited the UN to come and see the damage done by rebels. So at any rate, Lavrov is clarifying that this includes everybody, and I think everybody around the world who wants to see peace and a peaceful resolution in Syria. They need to know this is not just for the Syrian government. It includes everybody. The second thing it involves is that no Chapter 7 be invoked. The United States and France, they want it to be strictly, Syria must obey their orders or they will attack. Russia says no. You can't invoke the discussion of force here. What the United Nations Security Council has to say is Syria says it wants to give up these chemical weapons in agreement with other states. Therefore, we will go down that path. But you don't then say, unless you do it the way I want and as fast as I want, I'm going to attack. He said that's totally out of line. I'm repeating that news, and I urge you to look it up and learn about it. Anyway, there's that news. And as I'll just remind you again, we expect we will be talking to Charles McLaurin soon. The book, I want to remind you, is Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers, Memories of Mississippi, 1964-1965. And The author is Jim Dann, and you can get the book at baracabooks.com. In Toronto, you can certainly find it, I know, at a different book list. And the reason we have featured it, of course, is with Jim Dann. It was for one thing, he's a good friend of some of us, and we all know of the efforts he made early in his youth to join that great battle. And happily, he did what so many we always hope people will do, is write. He wrote a memoir of what it was like. So much of political discussion on these issues of the battle for civil rights in America turns on kind of historical overviews, but you don't know, well, what was it like to be in the car going down a country road at night in Mississippi to a meeting that the Klan has said has been canceled because they intend to kill everybody. That's what we want to know. Most of us want to know, then what did you do? And Jim Dann, who was one of the bravest people I ever met, he carried through with the action. And I think wrote a great chapter there. And I think we're joined now by Charles McLaughlin. McLaurin. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you very much. Jim Dann, in his new book, Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers, Memories of Mississippi, 1964-65, discusses what it was like for him, a college student from California, to go to Ohio and join a group of people and head out for the Delta, where you were located, at a time of total segregation in the American South and in which threats of violence were everywhere. You, of course, are one of the founders and leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Could you tell us, first of all, how important was that training? You know, he went through a week of something there in Ohio, and it seemed to be really important to prepare people for what was going to happen.
Yeah, I was there, and yes, I was a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or CORE.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved in that in the 60s in Jackson, Mississippi, where I was born when Freedom Riders came through. I got with Freedom Riders and my others and was inspired by them, got to the Delta and worked with Fannie Lou Hamer and other leaders in the Delta. But we, SNCC decided to have a summer project where we'd reach out to young college students and other professionals to come to Mississippi to help us break the segregation and white supremacy life that we were living under. So Jim Dann did come along with what happened. I met them in Oxford. I did something a lot of the SNCC people may not have done at Oxford. At Oxford, I started to select me a group as they were doing the training. Mm-hmm. I started walking around with Tracy Sugarman, who the artist that was on my project, who came down, and some. And I met Jim Dann and others, and I recruited these people and had them come to Ruleville to meet with me there, because I had been mobilizing in Sunflower County, Mississippi, since August of 1962, and we had very little results in terms of trying to get blacks registered to vote. So Jim and the group who came down, Jim Dann and other people who came down, they really helped us. Jim right away had some experience, and he talked about his having been involved with some organizations. John Harris was from Howard University, where he was involved in the SNCC movement up there. So these two guys right away were kind of high on my list of placing in leadership.
Yeah, Jim,
I
was going to say, in the book, Jim points out, he says that your position is almost like a general. You have to be careful where you put your troops, and you have to know they know how to fight and to survive.
Yeah, that's what that was all about. You know, it's really like Ella Baker put that group together, and she sent out SNCC people, and so now here's SNCC sending out people to come in to help us. Jim Dan, one of the things was that my license had been revoked as a result of a traffic accident that had been really, you know, a conspiracy to get me in jail anyway. But so Jim offered to drive me around. I said, I need a driver to take me places, and Jim volunteered. I appointed John Harris so that when I was away, he was in charge of our effort. And we knew that these night riders might just drive by and shoot into houses. They may just run you down on the highway, or they do the smart thing, as far as they're concerned, is to put you in jail and then turn you loose late at night so the Klan is waiting to get you.
Yeah, before Jim Dan left Ohio, they got the news, I guess almost on the day they were going down to meet with you, that Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney had been abducted. No one knew where they were, but they had disappeared.
Yes, but now look here. I said, well, this is over. You know, we may get a few people. But you see, but what happened was, you know, as a result of those murders, you would think that it would make people afraid, kind of, and they would be a little bit shy to not say, well, I don't want to go down there and just kind of find some other things to do, like go back to summer school or something like that. But these people seemed that they had faith in what they wanted to do. They kind of came in such a way that it was like an army invading, and I use the word invade lightly because the state said that's what it was, an invasion. Now, you think about American citizens coming into another state to work and help people is an invasion that's going to, get people hurt and get people killed. There's this opposition to people registering, to black folks registering to vote, and it's so strong that the state is willing to spend millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to maintain a system that should have been blowing in the wind.
Yeah, I mean, here you had, they were American citizens who were looking for help to fight to gain their freedom. You seemed
to... There was no help. There was no inside help. You know, we couldn't expect nothing from the state. It was the state against us.
Yes.
And so what we had to do was to mobilize some way of focusing attention on Mississippi, because it seemed as if the rest of the world had kind of left the black folks to be hound by, as long as you don't cause any problems, you don't do nothing other than what you usually do and lynch a few of them, we'll let you go. So the FBI, the Justice Department, the President of the United States, and nobody else was giving us the time of day.
Yes.
I mean, black folks didn't have no voice at all of protection and no form of protection, because they had taken the right to vote away from us. See, and the right, the voting is the most important weapon any American citizen has to address grievances. Because you can elect people to office. We didn't have nobody in office. When these people came to Mississippi in 1964, we didn't have a single black in elected office in the whole state.
And I got to ask you about that. Jim mentions that when you began there, some people had the idea, well, the federal government through the FBI will help us out. What was the FBI like when you were out risking your lives in one town or another?
Well, they came. We would send the reports to them or ask for their presence in some places, but they were mostly people that they took notes. You know, they watched the guy from a distance whoop your head and say how many licks he gave you, and never intervene, because too often the local police and sheriff and everybody else knew that the FBI person was there, and they've already told them how they wanted things down. See, it was a system that black folk were fighting. It was fighting big planters in the Delta, big rich, powerful business people, and the state of Mississippi. And so we had to reach out and get some help, and we were able to do that. Now look at this, what came out. Some people said, well, you didn't do nothing important. We had results. We challenged The Freedom Summer had three main objectives, and that was to continue the voter registration effort, which we knew we had to have, and to set up freedom schools to teach people now about the movement and about black history, and to try to raise the level of consciousness of the black people in the state and in the Delta, especially where they had just been released from the plantations as a result of mechanization, and the fact that blacks are now trying to register to vote, so now we don't need these people on the place. They were really slowly drifting off, but more got forced off at that time. Mm-hmm. And during the period of 1962 to 1964. But then the third part of that summer project objective was to organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Yes.
And to have the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge the seating of the Mississippi all white regular delegation in Atlantic City in 1964.
That was a dramatic moment. And boy, I remember that so vividly because that's Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yeah.
And Jim in his book describes an encounter between Bob Moses and Hubert Humphrey. Do you remember how could you talk about that? That was embarrassing.
What happened, you know, Lyndon Johnson wanted to be president of the United States. And the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, after Fannie Lou Hamer's, testimony, we were offered what was called a compromise. And Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale were the ones Lyndon Johnson sent to sell it to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And Humphrey and Bob and Mrs. Hamer had... words. Have you ever read?
They had words.
Yeah.
I recall. By Jim's account, they didn't. They really opposed her almost in class terms. They said, "Look at the way she dresses, and listen to the way she talks."
Yeah. But now, see, what they didn't realize that's true. That is exactly true. Is that she did not talk like they do. Who was she? She was a sixth grade sharecropper.
Mm-hmm.
Who had been homeschooled by her parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was wise in the use of the Bible and wise in having read the newspapers and listened to the radios and got the leftover magazines from the big house and stuff like that and everything that she could pick up. So she was wise enough. Then SNCC, now here we are, SNCC.
Mm-hmm.
But the one who motivated and stimulated Fannie Lou Hamer as she came into the movement. We brought her into the movement. She was our shining star.
Was it you who went to get her? She had been fired for registering to vote. And somebody had to go and find her and bring her back. And she emerged as a SNCC leader.
Yeah, I was assigned to go and find her. That's when I first met her.
Mm-hmm.
I had not met her before. I went to find her and brought her to the SNCC conference in the end of 1962.
Uh-huh.
And she joined SNCC right there. SNCC fell in love with her. Look what she was. Now think about this. Mm-hmm. Ella Baker, who was the founder of SNCC, you know, and SNCC grew out of the civil rights protest sit-ins and the beating over in Birmingham and what had gone on in Selma and all of that. But these young people now, Ella Baker got them together and organized Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and sent out leaders across the nation, across the South to help change things. But now, here's what happened. She told us to go find the people who have the least.
Wow.
Go to the men and women or families on those plantations and tell them that they need to help themselves, that they need to look around among them. They don't have to wait for the PhDs and all these other people to come and lead them. You need that. They're leaders among you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Fannie Lou Hamer came in. Hey, she's a grassroots person, a grassroots leader, poorly educated, but she did something that Dr. T.R.M. Howard, the NAACP, and everybody had been trying to do for a long time, and that was to get somebody outside of Mississippi to listen to us.
Uh-huh. And they did listen. You know, she really
national, did. National, international television.
Yeah. No,
she
was
there.
She had on the coast. She had more charisma than everybody else put together, in my memory. We're speaking to Charles McLaurin, and the subject is Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers, Memories of Mississippi, 1964 to 65, Jim Dan. That's barackabooks.com. And, you know, Charles, to me, what was really wonderful in the book, and must have been for you a tremendous thing, you spoke of the courage of people in the face of violence and the killings. When Jim got to one of the, I think it was Indianola or it might have been Ruleville, he said, here were all these young people ready to go. They were waiting for somebody. They weren't hanging back. You found yourself with a bunch of volunteers.
Yeah, we had a situation like that to happen in Drew, Mississippi, and we had that to happen over in Indianola. But it had to do with the kind of the stimulation that we had, you know, periodically. We had, before them and some people came down, we had gone into some of these communities with very little success of mobilizing them, but we would leave one or two people there would join us. You know, we would get an opportunity to talk to one or two kids who we later was able to get to pull together three or four of his or her friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then we then spread the word that way. But
for you,
we didn't know that in Indianola that some of the local people over there had stood up and was leading some that group that Jim and we came up on.
Mm-hmm.
Was really surprised, but young people responded to the movement,
mm-hmm.
and it's a young person's movement. I mean, after all, it was the young people who inspired it. NAACP and CORE and some of those organizations had been around for quite some time, and they were working hard. They were working mostly in the courts and trying to make sure we got some legal thing, but at the same time, we had a multitude of people back there who were not ready to meet the challenges that they were fixing to face.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim and the rest of us scattered out over the county, and when they got here, you know, I got them put in jail.
Yeah. Well, he said he describes a scene in one of the Delta communities where you arrived and they had a tremendous crowd of young people. And in a way, I think that must have been very challenging for you because they were ready to go into the street and it meant that people were going to be arrested. But it was all just sort of unfolding just because of the energy that you people of SNCC and others had brought out in these people. It was like they were ready to challenge every part of desegregation in their community, at wherever it was, whether it was the Dairy Queen, the motels, the movie theater, and they were going to boycott and did boycott the schools, and I don't even think they waited around for anybody's permission. They said they were going to just do it.
Yeah, that was kind of led by Mrs. Hamer's daughters, who were adopted daughters, who were in the local public schools in Ruleville. They did have a walkout, you know. But yeah, young people were ready to move. It was time for them, and it's time again for young people to step forward.
Yeah.
The baby boomers were us, and we so now we're into another group of a whole another movement here. To protect some of the gains that we made, in particular the Voting Rights Act.
I want to ask you about that, and I want to mention that this is Charles McLaurin, and the organization I think that I know you've already referred me to is the Mississippi Civil Rights Veterans.com, and I really urge everybody to go to that site. Now, of course, every generation has to pick it up. I noticed that you and Fannie Lou Hamer were speaking shortly before she died, and she said to you, "We're not free yet." And now we have the Supreme Court decision, which does a lot of damage to the victories you achieved in 1964 and 65, particularly the Voting Rights Act. So could you talk about what you're doing to fight back?
Well, we one thing, we're doing some organizing now. You know, the NAACP and other national organizations, I'm sure, will be really engaged in some actions. I think now that they're looking around at Attorney General Eric Holman and and Congress, and to see how that goes. And as, at the same time, we're kind of being vigilant. We're watching and we're listening. The veteran group that you went to, that I belong to in Jackson, filed a friend of the court brief in the Alabama case that Holder was bringing over there. And because we know we have some very important, some very powerful information about voting in Mississippi. As I mentioned earlier, in 1962, there was not a single black elected official in the state, and we were more almost 40% of the population.
Yes, and many of the communities, you're in 90%.
Yeah, and especially in the Delta, where we made our focus.
That's B.B. King country, by the way. One thing I learned from Jim Dan, B.B. King was from Indianola, or at least performed there.
Yeah, and there's a big museum here now, the B.B. King Museum, very upscale, out-of-sight museum. I mean, it's modern, and it's worth looking at it. So if you ever get a chance to, and you like the blues, come down to Sunflower County. The B.B. King Museum takes you back to era way behind and brings you to the to current.
Yeah, and by the way, there are other museums there and places that people can visit. I've seen photographs of yourself, that's Charles McLaurin, taking people on tours of some of these places where they were put in jail. You were jailed, I believe, 22 times. There were places where churches would burn, and in one year there, I think they burned 37 churches. Now, by the way, if I understand, I think you are arguing, too, that there should be an amendment to the American Constitution protecting the right to vote. You say that...
That's the thing that we're pushing. You know, because the vote is the essence of our democracy. I mean, if it's the right of the people to vote to put people into office, it ought to be a constitutional amendment that guarantees every American citizen the right to vote.
Yes.
And it ought to be protected. In other words, that no state or jurisdiction in the United States can do nothing to take the right to vote from a citizen.
Yes. But, and I think you underlined, you said they think it's sacred to have a gun. It ought to be sacred to have a vote.
Look, because that, to me, that's your very being. You're there. The gun is something that comes after the fact that you are a citizen with the right to protect your wife and family and friends, everything that's within your property line, you know, right to protect that. You know, I don't know if you got time. I got
go ahead.
A little we empowered, and I say that because we when the Ruleville community was shot up after Ms. Hamer went down and registered to vote in that busload, white people shot up, shot up the black community, wounded two girls. But the man that we were living with was a 76-year-old black man who could not read or write. His wife could read and write some, and he was 76, and she was, I think, about 69. And so SNCC sent us to live with them to help them organize the Ruleville community. And after the Klan shot up the houses, they shot into this man, Joe Mack's house, Joe McDonald's house. And the next day, the mayor of the town came and confiscated his gun. You know, his house had been shot into. Told him he was taking his gun for his protection. Hey, look, that's what happens. Us SNCC workers was living with him at a house, so when we got home that afternoon, he told us that the mayor came and took his gun. I said, oh, well, man, the mayor don't have no right to take your gun. You haven't done nothing. You haven't killed nobody. You know, and he carried it down. I said, you got a right to protect yourself with your family. And went to the book and showed him, you know, in the Second Amendment. And he said, fold that page down. The next morning, he was conspicuously absent from the table, because every morning we would get up with that family what we were going to do that day in terms of organizing and taking people to register to vote. So the next morning when we went to the table, he was not there. Joe Mack was not there. And his wife told us when we asked where he was, she said he'd gone to the city hall. So we just assumed you go to city hall to do a lot of things, mostly business. Never thought why he was going down there, maybe to pay his light bill, gas bill. But anyway, Charlotte, the guy pulls up in front of his gate in his truck, and he steps out holding his gun high, you know, holding it high so his neighbors could see it, because this is a small community, and the word was all around that the mayor had been to his house and took his gun. Now, all of his neighbors also knew that we was living in there with him, and the white people didn't like it. So they were kind of a little worried about him and that kind of stuff, too, because they didn't want to tell him to throw us out. So, but anyway, what he did, he went down there, and he said, when he told us, and we recorded this, that the mayor told him when he came in, you know, tight head, so-and-so, you're going to get killed, something's going to happen to you. And he said, "Mayor, I come to get my gun." And the mayor told him, said, "Now, look, I'm going to tell you." He said, "Mayor, I just come to get my gun." And the mayor said, "Well, now," and he said, he laid that book down on the desk and said, "Mayor, come here, please." And said, "Look right there. Do that say I got a right to have a gun?" And said, "Mayor, step back, amazed," and gave him his gun.
Man,
and told him that he was going to get hurt. But the next day, where we had only been having 10 or 15 people at a mass meeting, the church was overflowing. We had people standing outdoors to hear his story, because what he had done, he had raised the consciousness of people to the fact that there was somebody that might be able to stop the white man from them back. And they shouted on us and him. You see what I'm saying? So we became kind of, we became so important that they would call us up and tell us anytime anything went on around the community, you know. So we were there. We were organized.
What, boy, you're talking about that, his rights.
And
I think you're onto something, a constitutional amendment. Charles McLaurin, I think Jim was really lucky you picked him out to be your driver, and we're very grateful that you could take the time to talk to us. It's a wonderful
Jim was
book.
A wonderful guy.
He was,
you know,
a wonderful
another
guy.
Thing was, I made him speed all the time, you know. I made him speed because I told him, I said, never let, if we're on the highway at night going someplace, never let the life of a vehicle go around us. If it's coming up on us, we don't never want them to get alongside us or in front of us. And man, and Jim never did. He never allowed. We'd be driving 95 miles per hour to keep ahead of any cars that's behind us on a dark road leading into one of those towns or counties.
Boy, that's
Jim was it. He became my real friend. Yeah. We became so friendly that we would go out. I'd go out of town, and he'd drive me there, and I'd make him let him in the meetings and everything. He was the guy who, he was faithful, and he didn't seem to be afraid.
Absolutely,
you know, I never saw fear in his face. When sometime I might have been bumping at the knees, but we were friends for one another. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
because he was constantly with me.
Well, he had that amazing quality, and it was a great combination, yourself and Jim Dan, and it's produced a great book, Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers, Memories of Mississippi, Jim Dan. And Charles McLaurin, we're very, very grateful. I hope we can talk to you again here about this project of getting a constitutional amendment.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that this summer, next year, 2014, is the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, and we are hosting a program here for 3 days in Indianola, and the state is also bringing back any of those young people, those now senior citizens who were young people then, back for a celebration. So we're going to have a few of them here in the county.
Good.
You ought to take a trip down here.
We will do that, and we will certainly follow it. And we again, thank you very, very much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Charles McLaughlin. McLaurin. My apologies. Charles McLaurin, SNCC leader, challenging the Mississippi Firebombers. Jim Dan, And it's barakabooks.com and a different book list in Toronto. And we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and find out about this protest.